All right, please be seated. I'll accept for Justice Kurofsky, who will likely remain standing because she's had a little bit of a back issue, so make nothing of it other than it helps her deal with pain better.
I'm taller than Justice Dallet this way.
It's actually the only way.
That's right. One way or the other, you get there.
To even out and be a little closer to Justice Hagedorn's height down there, so have the bench equal. Okay, first case today is Jeffrey Becker versus Dane County, 21 AP 1382. Appearances, please. All right, good morning. The lineup is 25 minutes, followed by 30 and 5 minutes in rebuttal, correct? All right, proceed.
Luke Berg for appellants Jeffrey Becker, Andrea Klein, and A Leap Above Dance. May it please the court. For nearly 2 years now, Dane County's health officer has controlled much of life in Dane County through her own ever-changing municipal code. She has issued 23 orders over that time, often with little to no advance notice. Among other things, those orders banned gatherings in private homes and businesses, set capacity limits, dictated which sports can be played and how, and required all individuals to wear masks, including on two-year-olds. Dane County is the only county in the state that I'm aware of to operate this way. Now, what's enabled all of this is a Dane County ordinance that was adopted just days after this court's decision in Palm. That ordinance preemptively makes it a citable offense to violate anything that she subsequently puts in any order she deems reasonable and necessary.
Counsel, you're not, as I understand it, arguing about the substance of any particular order, correct?
That's correct. This is about her authority to pass these orders.
So it doesn't matter whether there's the orders were to ban private gatherings in homes. Let's assume that's not permitted. That would be an overbroad order. You're not challenging that.
We are not challenging the content of the orders, but I think the content of the orders illustrates how broad of an authority she asserts, and that's relevant both to the non-delegation question and to the proper interpretation of the statute.
So your argument, as I understand it, is that no local health officer may issue any order whatsoever with any particular scope or substance under 252.03. Is that right?
Our position is under 252.03, general take all measures necessary provision. That provision, the general provision, doesn't authorize enforceable general orders.
Do you think a local health officer could forbid public gatherings under 252.03?
Yes.
Could a public health officer do that via order?
Yes.
Okay. So some orders are okay, but only ones, just the reasonable and necessary, you don't think that authorizes any other kind of order?
That's correct. The reason a health officer can forbid public gatherings is because that's explicit in the text of 252.03. So that doesn't violate the statute because the statute authorizes that. And it doesn't violate the non-delegation doctrine because it's specifically authorized, it's limited, and it isn't an open-ended grant of authority.
Sure. What if a local health officer issued an order saying all local businesses should promulgate and distribute local health guidelines to their employees? Is that problematic in your view?
Yes.
Okay.
That's an enforceable order issued by the health department, and that's not permitted anywhere under the text of 252.03, and it's not permitted by the general take all measures necessary.
What if it had no enforcement mechanism? What if it was just an order? There was no ordinance citation attached to it. There was no fine. There was no fee. There was nothing along those lines. Just an order. Does that change your analysis at all?
If it was not enforceable, if it was a recommendation, then that would be fine. That would be permissible.
Well, what if it was an order with no penalty, which is not a very good order, but still, you know, a mandate. I think, you know, from the news, Milwaukee has done something like that, right? I think their mask mandate. I don't know the scope of their order. Obviously, it's not in the record, but let's assume you had something like that. Is that problematic in your view?
I don't quite understand what it means to have an order without some method of enforcement. I would say that's not allowed because there is nothing in the statute that authorizes local health officials to issue orders. So the first question in this case is a matter of statute interpretation. The basis for all of the orders is this phrase, take all measures necessary. So the question is, what measures are authorized? And 252.03 doesn't answer that question. It doesn't say anything about what measures are authorized. So this court has to look elsewhere for clues. And I think there are multiple clues that indicate that enforceable orders are not authorized by that section. So I'll go through them. The first one, and I think the most persuasive one, is 252.02. The adjacent provision for DHS contains a similar general authorization for DHS to take all measures necessary.
Counsel, in listening to your argument just moments ago, you transposed the word authorized for necessary. And of course, the statute uses the language necessary, all measures necessary. And you said all measures authorized. Was that a slip, or do you think necessary necessarily means authorized?
I'm not quite sure what Your Honor is referring to. The text of the statute says all measures necessary.
Yes, I'm referring to what you said now about 2 minutes ago.
Right.
You said that the text said all measures that are necessary. That is, all measures that are authorized. And I think authorized and necessary are different things. So I'm asking you, is that a slip? In other words, not intentional? Or do you believe necessarily incorporates authorization?
What I meant to say is the question in the case is what measures are authorized by 252.03. I'm not saying the word authorizes in the text of the statute, but the question is, what measures does 252.03 authorize? Mm-hmm. And 252.02, the adjacent provision, contains a similar broad general authorization to take all measures necessary, but separately and explicitly says that DHS can issue orders. It uses that language specifically. 252.03 does not contain any authorization to issue orders.
Thank you.
So that contrast indicates that DHS has that power and local health officials do not.
Mr. Berg, I just heard you, in response to Justice Hagedorn's questions, though, indicate that a local health officer could issue an order forbidding public gatherings, but I don't see the word order in there. So can you tell me how that can be?
Because 252.03 says separately that local health officials can forbid public gatherings.
But it doesn't say order in that section.
So it doesn't, but of course.
How do you read order into that and not into the other section?
Because the word forbid public gatherings suggests a compulsive order, right? You can't forbid public gatherings without some sort of enforceable order.
And but so shall take all reasonable, all reasonable and necessary measures does not indicate any type of order in the word shall, but may forbid public gatherings indicates an ability to order.
Right, and you see that in 252.02. The legislature put that in 252.02. State health department can forbid public gatherings. That's one power in 252.02. And the state health department has a separate power to issue. The legislature views those as two separate things, and it gave that power to DHS and not to local health officials.
So, Mr. Berger, is the distinction you're making that an order is something that is enforceable?
Yes.
So then I'm not understanding how your argument is consistent with 251.06 sub 3 sub C, which says, and as I'm sure you know, 251.06 is the local health officer's qualifications and duties. And that statute says that a local health officer shall enforce any regulation that the local board of health adopts and any ordinance that the relevant governing body enacts if those regulations and ordinance are consistent with state public health statutes and rules.
Right. That section does not authorize local health officials to issue their own orders. It references two things: a regulation by the local board of health. There's no dispute in this case that none of the orders have been issued by the board of the health as a regulation.
I'm going to give you that one, but how about the next word?
And next, ordinances that the relevant governing body enacts. This is not an ordinance that the county board has enacted. In fact, that's our whole argument in this case, is that Dane County can have these restrictions if it wants, but it needs to be adopted in an ordinance by the county board. It can't be adopted unilaterally in an order by the local health official. So that provision does not authorize local health official orders either. I would also add that the power to issue regulations by the local board of health, there's a constraint on that. The only type of regulations that the board of health can issue are for its own governance and the internal operations of the health department. And so even the board of health couldn't issue a regulation imposing a mask mandate on a town or a county. That has to be done by the local governing body, the county board.
Council, I want to look a little at the statutory history because, you know, this is obviously a statute we're becoming more and more familiar with here at this court. But this statutory scheme was largely adopted in 1919 after the wake of the Spanish flu. The original text that was enacted said that the local board of health, with the consent of the state board of health, shall have power to establish quarantine and to order and execute what is reasonable and necessary for the prevention and suppression of disease. Then in 1923, they sort of reformulate the language. They take out the order language, but leave it substantially the same. They do something similar for the Department of Health. And the Attorney General sort of opines it was a recodification of the statutes, a reformulation of the statutes. The separate order language you find in DHS doesn't really show up until 1981 when that's added in there, I think. And so I'm trying to figure out what to make of that statutory history, and obviously our job is to be faithful to the text. So do you have any comment on that at all?
I do, absolutely. So in 1923, as you note, the court removed that broad language saying in the communicable disease section that a board of health could issue orders. So the language you see in 252.03 was largely the same in 1923. There was a separate series of statutes, 140.01, 140.02, 140.03, which provided different sets of authority for different types of boards of health. It's very confusing because there was a lot of different, there was commissions, there was boards of health, so there's different types. If the court looks at 140.02 and 140.03, for different types of boards of health, it did explicitly authorize orders, but there was a provision. It said any order that those boards or commissions issues has to be submitted to the city council for ratification and is not enforceable until ratified by the city council, which is exactly the point we're making in this case. That provision was in the statute until about 1961, when the legislature consolidated it. And there was a discussion in the legislative history about whether to include this order provision, and the legislature decided not to. So the initial draft of that 1961 bill included broader language to authorize orders by the new Board of Health in the consolidated statute, and it was removed from a draft. And the commentary was, this is not appropriate. Now, there's some mixed commentary on it.
So could a local board then forbid public gatherings, but are you arguing that would also need to be submitted to, would that need to be submitted in some way? Or because that's explicit, like how does that interact with your argument about the forbid public gatherings language?
That does not need to be submitted because that is explicitly authorized in the statute. It doesn't violate the statutory text because it is authorized. And it doesn't violate the non-delegation doctrine because it's a much more limited scope and because the legislature has defined the what local health officials can do. They can forbid public gatherings. But an open-ended, broad grant to do whatever is reasonable and necessary that doesn't define the what, doesn't answer any of the policy questions, so it would violate the non-delegation doctrine. And for multiple reasons, the statutes indicate that broad language doesn't actually include enforceable orders. So I've only covered one of the indications, 252.02, but let me go through the rest. 323.14 is a provision that authorizes a county in an emergency to, quote, order by ordinance or resolution whatever's necessary for health and safety. Now, if there isn't time for the county board to act, the county executive can exercise that power, but only until the county board can act and ratify or strike down the order issued by the county executive. So the contrast between 323.14, which does include the word order, and 252.03, which does not, again indicates that the power to issue orders is vested only in DHS via 252.02 or county boards in 323.14. And it also indicates that the legislature expects the local governing body to be involved during a crisis. Indication number three, there is no enforcement mechanism anywhere in state law for an general order issued by a local health official. There is no dispute about that in this case. That's exactly why Dane County passed its ordinance. So one would think that the legislature would include an enforcement mechanism if it intended local health officials.
Well, what about the forbid public gatherings? What's the enforcement mechanism for that?
I acknowledge there is no explicit enforcement mechanism for that under state law either. So that, I think, is an oversight. A county board could adopt an ordinance imposing a penalty for that. Again, that wouldn't violate the statute because the authority is explicitly in the text, and it wouldn't violate the non-delegation doctrine for the reasons that I've discussed. But aside from that, in most circumstances where the legislature does allow enforceable orders, it doesn't provide an enforcement mechanism. So two examples are 252.06 relating to isolation and quarantine orders. There the legislature explicitly authorized orders and provides a detailed enforcement mechanism. 254.59 allows for orders to abate a health nuisance in a property, so local health officials can inspect properties for sanitary conditions during a crisis. If they find them, it can order the property to remedy those conditions and do so under 252.59. 252.041 allows orders for compulsory vaccination in certain cases. 252.07 has special orders for tuberculosis. So there's a lot of different statutes that do explicitly allow for orders, and in each case, the legislature ordinarily provides an enforcement mechanism. I would also call this court's attention to 252.25. That is the general default penalty for violations of health rules and statutes, and that statute references state statutes and rules, DHS orders, and local ordinances. The one thing that you'll notice is conspicuously missing is an order of a local health official. So presumably if that was something contemplated under the law, the legislature would have referenced that in 252.25.
Counsel, why does the failure to have an enforcement mechanism for the language in the statute prohibiting public gatherings, why is that to be cast as a legislative oversight rather than an infirmity in your argument? And I'm not saying your argument is infirm, but the idea of a response, well, the legislature just overlooked this, is not persuasive. So tell me why it doesn't undermine your...
It would be one thing if the legislature had said in 252.03, local health officials can issue orders. It said that for DHS in 252.02. So if it had said that in 252.03, but then didn't include an enforcement mechanism, we wouldn't be here. But 252.03 doesn't say that. It doesn't reference orders anywhere. And it doesn't reference enforcing anything anywhere, except in later in the provision, but it references enforcing other things like state statutes and rules. So the point is, 252.03 says nothing about what measures it's talking about. And so this court has to look for clues elsewhere, and there are a lot of clues, I've just surveyed them, that indicate that the measures contemplated did not include enforceable orders. Now, this doesn't mean that local health officials have no power. There are a lot of things that local health officials can still do to control, prevent, and suppress disease that don't require enforcement. They can do contact tracing and testing. They can do vaccination. They can do data collection and publication. They can do surveillance and investigation. They can do training, public education and awareness. They can work with community-based initiatives. They can issue recommendations to businesses and schools. They can even develop proposed ordinances to suggest to the county board, but the one thing they can't do, because it's not authorized anywhere in the statutes, is issue their own enforceable orders unilaterally. Now, unless there are more questions on the statute, I'd like to turn to the non-delegation doctrine. And I'd like to start with the forest here. The purpose of the non-delegation doctrine is to prevent the concentration of legislative and executive power into one person's hands. And that's exactly what's been happening in Dane County. Dane County's health officer has single-handedly been drafting, interpreting, and enforcing her own code unilaterally. There's no dispute about that set of facts here. So that alone proves that there's a non-delegation problem here somewhere. And the question then is where? And there's only two things that the health officer has relied on for authority, the ordinance and the statute. So our position is one or the other of these has to violate the non-delegation doctrine. Our argument is that the problem lies in the ordinance because the statute doesn't authorize this and the ordinance attempts to convert that power into the police power. But if this court concludes that the statute itself does allow this broad of a power by local health officials, then that is the non-delegation problem. Now,
Counsel, do you acknowledge that the non-delegation is separation of powers? It's your constitutional issue, and you have the burden to prove any ordinance or statute beyond a reasonable doubt. You have to prove that it's unconstitutional. You agree with your burden?
Yes, sir.
And all presumptions are in favor of constitutionality. You agree with that?
Yes.
It is unclear to me how you can advance. I'm not sure about the scope of the non-delegation doctrine, so I'm concerned that you're not meeting that beyond a reasonable doubt that the non-delegation doctrine applies to localities. What's your best argument that you've met a burden beyond a reasonable doubt that it applies to localities?
Well, the Constitution says so. So Article 4, Section 22 says the legislature can delegate limited legislative authority on county boards. And this court, in multiple cases, most notably Mead and Marshall, has interpreted that constitutional provision to mean that local legislative power can only be vested on the county board. It can't be put elsewhere. There are also multiple statutory provisions that vest local legislative power in a county board. There are numerous cases from this court where this court has acknowledged that legislative power can't be delegated by a county board or city council to cities, for example, to individuals, to other people. And there are multiple attorney general opinions as well, making the same point. So I think it's well established that the non-delegation doctrine applies at the local level. Even respondents don't dispute that. They concede that it does apply at the local level. They just don't explain when or why it doesn't apply here. But I think everybody agrees it does apply. The question is how it applies, and we've asked this court to revisit that doctrine because that is the first part of any analysis, is what is the legal test. And so we've asked this court to reconsider that doctrine for multiple reasons. The court's current doctrine is not consistent with the constitutional design. Multiple justices on this court and the U.S. Supreme Court have noted that. The current version of the doctrine has not worked. This court has not overturned anything on the non-delegation doctrine for a very long time. This court's doctrine is also an outlier among the states, as this court even noted itself. The issue has been squarely presented in this case and fully briefed. There is also a robust body of academic writing and historical research that this court can draw on. So I think the time is ripe for this court to revisit and reconsider the non-delegation doctrine in this case.
Counsel, if we agreed with your interpretation of 25203, that there is no enforcement provision in it as we compare it with 25202, which has one, wouldn't we have then to construe the ordinance consistent with that, such that the ordinance itself could not provide enforcement provisions? In other words, we could interpret it, and I think subsection 2 is the biggest problem of the ordinance, but we could interpret it narrowly consistent with the statutory limitation on what a local health officer can do in regard to enforcement. And if we interpreted it narrowly, we wouldn't need to get to the non-delegation doctrine, would we?
I think this court does need to reach the non-delegation doctrine in this case for multiple reasons. Number one is the ordinance is in place, and respondents may assert that the ordinance, and have suggested in their brief, that the ordinance provides an independent source of authority for these orders. As we cited in our reply brief, on page 16 of their brief, they suggest that the ordinance is an independent source of authority to do this. So that's reason number one. Now, even if this court did, as you're suggesting, and interpreted the ordinance, I still think it's necessary to reach the question because it is an important issue. It's been fully presented in this case. I think the motivation behind the constitutional avoidance doctrine is typically to messing up constitutional doctrine when it's unnecessary to do so. But here, that cuts the opposite direction.
Well,
the non-delegation...
It only cuts the opposite direction if 252.03 is interpreted contrary to your assertion.
I see my red light is on. May I answer or should I?
You may answer.
Again, I think the respondents could reassert that the ordinance provides independent authority. They could also modify the ordinance after this decision to make the delegation more explicit. And then we'd be right back where we'd have to go through this whole process again, and we'd be right back here. So this has been raised at every level. The circuit court ruled on it. I think it's squarely presented here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. Ramsey Batar, Municipal Law and Litigation Group in Waukesha, Wisconsin. I'm pleased to represent Dane County, City of Madison, and Public Health, Madison-Dane County, as well as Ms. Heinrich in this matter. This court should not substitute its judgment for the policy choices bodies. Democratically elected state legislature made a policy choice to put the fight against a communicable disease, as we saw in this pandemic, to the boots on the ground at the local level, as well as to create a dual system at the state level. The local governing bodies here also made a policy to create the Public Health Madison-Dane County, to create its board that oversees it, and to retain control through the city and county governments. Local government in this state creates these type of arrangements all the time, every day. This is not a tripartite system of government. These are local governments that operate vastly different than states and the federal government.
Counsel, I give you that a dictatorship, which is what Heinrich exercised for about 2 years in Dane County, is the most efficient manner of handling a problem you're focusing on. But it is not necessarily a democratic manner. Okay, and can you explain for me why it's necessary that there be this enforcement in a local official when the county board has the authority to specifically issue an ordinance consistent with some of the actions that you...
Well, and the respondents here would disagree with that characterization that she's been running it as a dictatorship.
Well, she's making the orders unilaterally. She's enforcing them unilaterally. So when I said dictatorship, I mean one person making all the decisions.
The fundamentals of legislative rulemaking are threefold. Number one, declare whether or not there shall be a law. Here, the state legislature did that in 252.03, and the county did that in 46.40, saying that the local health officer shall do all that is reasonable and necessary to curb and suppress a pandemic. Number two is
to lay... How do you square your position with James V. Heinrich? Because we completely rejected in that case the idea that reasonable and necessary means anything and everything.
In that case, the court specifically noted that every word of the statute has to be given meaning. The court said that forbidding public gatherings was one element of the statute, along with, for example, it used for example. So it was an illustrative list, according to the James Court, in terms of what can be done. And when the court got to its analysis of religious liberties, it looked specifically to whether less restrictive methods could have been deployed in that case. And the court specifically noted that less restrictive means, such as student limits, which is capacity levels, mass or social distancing, all could have been deployed as they were in earlier cases. The statute, the words of 252.03, every word has to be given meaning. It's absurd to say that the local health officer can only forbid gatherings and do nothing further.
But that's exactly what we said in James v. Heinrich. We said that the more specific language controls, otherwise you would be reading out of the statute the explicit grants of authority, for example, may forbid public gatherings.
Right, and that was contextual because there was language within 252.03 to inspect schools, and there was language under DHS's authority under 252.02 to close schools. So the court was trying to reconcile the language or the health order that she had implemented to close schools relative to those other statutes allowing whether there can be an inspection of schools or closing of schools. That power to close schools was not within the plain language of 252.03. But nonetheless, the court in James, paragraph 45, talked about the less restrictive means of student limits, masking, social distancing. The court said earlier on in its statutory analysis render every word operative. I'm sorry.
You're incorporating some things from the constitutional analysis into the textual analysis, and I want to turn you back to Justice Rebecca Bradley's question on that. The text says you can do some things, and then it has this sort of reasonable and necessary language. One of the arguments that was made in Heinrich was, you know, essentially this reasonable and necessary is a broad grant of authority to do what the local health officer thinks is in the best judgment here. And Heinrich at least suggested that based on the statutory language that it's not that broad. It can't be read that broad because it doesn't make sense of the other explicit grants of authority that are there. And you see something similar to that here, right? It says, for example, forbid public gatherings. Might make some sense to think that reasonable and necessary wouldn't include forbidding private gatherings, for example. And so what limitations do you have? And I'm sorry, Justice Bradley, if you want to follow up further. But just want to return back to the textual argument, which is different than the constitutional argument.
We are not asking, the county and the respondents here are not asking that 252.03 be read as an open-ended grant of authority to do anything and everything. The boundaries are that it has to be reasonable and necessary.
But we said in James that does not give the local health officer the authority to do what is reasonable and necessary, whatever she thinks is. For example, in 252.03, what gave her the authority to tell the people of Dane County that they could not have whomever they wished into their private homes on Thanksgiving Day? What gave her that authority statutorily?
Two things. First of all, it's the facts and circumstances of the pandemic at the time. But to your question about the authority, it is contained within the city and county's adoption, creation of the Board of Public Health and the PHMDC. 251.02, when they create this entity, it is, quote, subject to the control of the city and county acting jointly, close quote. That's 252.02.1M. And when you look at the IGA agreement, it specifically spells out the duties and obligations. The county here can pull back the authority any time on the local health officer. It considered doing so this past fall when a resolution was circulated by some of the board members to pull back that authority. So at the local level, there is oversight all the time, and they can pull back. They adopted an ordinance that said her orders to suppress and control the pandemic was the policy choice that they wanted to make, and it made them enforceable.
That sounds like a loophole to get around the limits that the legislature expressly put into Section 252.03, and it also then implicates the non-delegation doctrine. It was over 100 years ago in Nierbas v. Harper that this court said under our constitutional form of government, the legislature cannot delegate legislative powers to any officer or to any body of persons, individual or corporate, aside from the power to confer local legislative and administrative powers on county boards. If the state cannot delegate such power, certainly a common council cannot re-delegate, or I would use the word sub-delegate, legislative power properly delegated to it. I mean, where would it end?
Yeah, and I believe the Nierbas case is where the county or the city put the authority for land use planning, whether a local resident can have a garage or not, they put that decision-making in the hands of his neighbors.
That's true, but it's the principles that were pronounced in that case are not limited to the delegation of authority to a private person. It's very clearly laid out that a common council cannot redelegate legislative power.
And that brings us to what is the legislative power, because collectively French, Dulof, and Nierbas all allow a delegation. So what does that mean? The concern of the court in those cases was laying down the fundamentals of the law. Those three things I tried to talk about earlier, declaring whether you're going to have a law on a particular policy, determining the general purpose of the law, and number three, fixing the limits within that law. Once the legislature has declared that policy choice, its role is generally complete, and it can leave to the executive to execute the laws and to utilize judgment and discretion in doing so.
But it's got to be limited by the statutory grant of power. In your briefing, you said, nor can it be doubted that Section 25203's terms are a complete and ministerial command to the local health officer. I agree with you if we accept your friend on the other side's analysis and position on 25203, which I think is most consistent with James v. Heinrich. But if we accept your construction of the statute, which expansively interprets what is reasonable and necessary, then everything is left to the judgment of the local health officer. So that delegation wouldn't be proper, right?
It would be problematic if there was no oversight by the county board or the governance over her actions. In this case, the difficulty for them in this case is that the city of Madison and Dane County have elected to create PHMDC. They have further made a policy choice to create the ordinance empowering her to act as she did. Some counties haven't done that. They've made a separate policy choice that they're not creating a joint entity. They've made a separate policy choice that they don't want to do anything about the pandemic. At the local level, municipal government, that is how it works. It cannot be that because some counties have elected to go down a policy choice where they're not creating this type of board and they're not making a decision to combat the pandemic through the local health officer. They got it right, but Dane County didn't get it right.
You can characterize it as a policy choice, but the local governments still have to comply with the Constitution. And Section 22 of Article 4 simply doesn't permit, as this Court has long interpreted it, just does not permit that delegation of power. In other words, just like the legislature can't give its power to another branch of government, the county boards cannot give away the power that the people gave to it, because it comes from the people, right?
Absolutely agree. And they didn't give Ms. Heinrich a veto. They didn't give her the power over spending or appropriation. They didn't give her the power over taxation. These are core legislative matters. The other core legislative matter is to make a policy choice. Here, the policy choice was made through the ordinances.
Do you think that the Constitution permits her to tell people what can go on in their own homes?
No, unless she is approved to do so through the local governing body. And that's what makes this case different than some of the cases that they rely upon from the state level. It has never been the case that when the executive acts on delegated authority, that it doesn't have any kind of discretion. The legislature has neither the bandwidth, it's not omnipotent, it can't possibly put in every detail in a statute, and the case law in this state and at the federal level recognizes that. Justice Scalia has repeatedly recognized that in the Mastrada case
involving the National Pollution Act, as well as in Whitman versus American Trucking. I'm sorry, Mistrada involved criminal sentencing. And he specifically noted that it's all a matter of degree. How much is too much? What is imminent?
Well, that goes to Justice Hagedorn's earlier question. What are the limits on your power? You're saying, well, the Common Council can veto it, but in the meantime, there are people subjected to what you in your brief characterized as despotic rule. You cite Novotny v. City of Milwaukee from 1909 for the proposition that a health officer who is expected to accomplish any results must necessarily possess large powers and be endowed with the right to take summary action, which at times must trench closely upon despotic rule. Are you advocating despotic rule by a single unelected person?
No, not at all. And I believe that case was cited in the context of where does this language act reasonably and necessary to control, suppress a pandemic come from. It comes from all of those earlier cases that talk about the police power of the executive branch to try to tackle something like communicable diseases. And when you look at all of those earlier decisions, such as the one you just pointed out, that's where the legislature got this language in 1919 when it created the statute at issue here, put those powers in the local health officer. The legislature has never gone back, despite many opportunities, as this court noted in James, to take a look at the statute. It has never gone back and made a separate policy choice that those powers should be any different than as they currently stand. Delegating authority, as the legislature did here under 252.03, was also their way to exercise a legislative power.
Council?
Yes.
I want to focus on some arguments advanced found in two of the amicus briefs that are filed, and I want to know your opinion or argument with regard to these. First, the League of Wisconsin Municipalities has indicated that application of the non-delegation doctrine to local health officer authority to issue orders under 252.03 has the potential, and this is what I'm emphasizing, has the potential to unravel the framework of local government in Wisconsin. That's what the League of Municipalities is advancing. That's the first part of an amicus that I want you to comment on. The second is from the amicus of the legal scholars in support of neither party. They take the position that unlike the feds and unlike state government, where there you can point to the constitutional provisions with regard to the tripartite division, the three branches of government, they say in page 6, local legislative power, by contrast, are not defined by any tripartite division of powers, but instead by statutory home rule. Their argument is that the federal and state constitutional separation of power principles don't apply to Wisconsin local government. So start with that one and then go to the non-delegation unraveling the framework of local government, as the League of Municipalities asserts.
I think the local scholars did a good job here of trying to present to the court the differences at the local government versus what you see at the state and federal level. When the argument was first presented that non-delegation theory applied, for me and my firm, as someone who practices in municipal law, this has never been utilized at the local level. There's no concepts of separation of powers at the local level. And I think the local scholars really brought that home. Local bodies, whether it's a city council or a county board, are not bicameral bodies. In this state, under Article 4, as well as some of the statutes, the county boards here in particular have not just local legislative power, they also have administrative character. They also have other attributes, specifically local legislative administrative character. There's home rule power that was granted to them to handle their local affairs. For cities and villages, that was a constitutional amendment that our state citizens put into play back in 1924, I believe. And that was carried over to counties to have that kind of local administration in 1985, and 1985 Wisconsin Act 29. And so that's why you have these differences at the local level. You don't have these concerns that Ms. Heinrich is out there all alone doing her own orders without the ability to pull back the reins. At the local government level, all manner of department heads and officials, agencies, it can be the police chief. If the community doesn't want speeding tickets, they can say no more speeding tickets. They can say increase the speeding tickets. And when we think about local health officers, as we saw in the news around this state, some of them were run out of town. That's because that's how it works at the local level. In terms of the league and the league's, Milwaukee's amicus brief, they do speak to the unintended, unforeseen consequences of trying to apply this this doctrine. And it's absolutely true. These consequences have not been thought through. They've not been discussed at all by the petitioners here. Their tests are ambiguous and in many ways just a restatement, reformulation of this court's precedent, but without really thinking about, well, what does this mean? What does this mean at the local level? They might offer some very good questions in terms of reinvigorating the doctrine at the federal level and maybe even at the state level. But these have nobody has thought through the ramifications at the local level. And I would encourage this court to consider the league's brief about those unintended consequences.
But there's a good reason for that, counsel, right? Because we're not supposed to look at the consequences of applying the law. We're supposed to just apply the law, right?
You are to apply the law, but I would hope that this court is considering how does it apply not just in this case, but all related cases or similar cases or down the road. That's why we set precedent.
Is non-delegation the law, Mr. Vitar, and especially when it comes to local government? Is there anywhere that we can look to where this is? Isn't this a new concept that's being introduced to us by Mr. Berg?
It's absolutely a new concept when we're discussing it at the local level. This concept of non-delegation, as they've argued from the federal case law and the scholars they rely upon, many interesting observations by Justice Gorsuch and others about what this means at the federal level and looking back at what the founders meant. But as you look at all of that stuff, even the founders had disagreement about delegation.
Counsel,
it's not clear at all.
Counsel, I just asked you a question about Narbaugh v. Harper. It's 1916. In response, you mentioned a number of other cases. These are Wisconsin Supreme Court decisions that expressly mention the concept of non-delegation at the local level. So I'm very puzzled by your response to Justice Dalla to say that this just doesn't exist, that it's just a new concept. It sounds quite old. Over 100 years is quite old, isn't it?
Well, the way that the petitioners are presenting their quote-unquote reinvigorated doctrine, it is all flowing from the concerns of Justice Gorsuch in the
Gundy
decision 2 years ago, and concerns that come out of the original federalism history, the text of the U.S. Constitution. That doesn't apply at the local level, but to your question, you're absolutely right. French, Duluth, and Narbaugh were all cases that had a situation where it was questioned whether there can be a delegation of taxes to a tax committee, I think, in one of those cases. The other case allowed some individual or committee to oversee a bridge construction, and then the Narbaugh case that we talked about earlier. So those cases, you're right, did involve a delegation under this court's principles. And this court's principles have always said that delegation of the power to make rules and effectively administer a given policy is a necessary ingredient of an efficiently functioning government. The courts in those cases allow there to be a level of delegation, and that has continued in a straight line in all of this court's cases all the way through Gilbert, involving the medical examination board revocations, where the standard was, quote, detrimental to the best interests of the public, close quote, or, quote, any practice which tends to constitute a danger to the public health, welfare, and safety. It continued into the Koshki case, these principles.
But
these principles are not...
That's all true. But in this case, we're in this pandemic situation where I think everybody would agree extraordinary powers have been claimed by government officials at every level, from the federal down to the local. But why are the concerns any different for the people subjected to these rules and orders, whether it's the federal government doing it, the state government doing it, or the local government doing it? Because here we have a single individual who is making the law. Here's her multi-page order. She's also enforcing the law by slapping fines on people who are not complying with her order. And then she's also interpreting it, and I guess, you know, the petitioners in this case were supposed to go to a blog and find this guidance that talks about how kids who are participating in a dancing school somehow are subject to the courts, fields, and sports section of her order. So she's also interpreting it, when how the heck is anybody supposed to know that a dance group is subjected to courts, fields, and sports regulations? You can't concentrate. Our constitutional structure does not allow this concentration of executive, legislative, and judicial power in the hands of one person, much less somebody who is not elected.
And we have certainly seen those overreaches at the state level around the country and even at the federal level, as you suggested. And it's because in some of those cases, there has been an abdication of the legislative power altogether, or there has been a stealing away, such as a governor, whether it doesn't matter the state, making decisions that really belong to the legislature under the tripartite branches. That's not what, in this case, is different again because of the way it's set up at the local level through the creation, through an ordinance and through the IGA creating the public health department. Then again, through the policy choice in the ordinance that the local health officer's decision to do what is reasonable and necessary is going to be the local law. So that's different than those other overreach cases. I'd also point out, if I may just finish, in this case, they have not sued the Board of Public Health. They've conducted no discovery whatsoever about the policies, what's underlying them, why these orders are they are. As they said in the introduction, they're not challenging many of the restrictions. That's even in the amended complaint at paragraph 2. They don't object to any of this because they're launching an attack on 252.03. Judge Hagedorn.
Counsel, do you believe, and you've cited some of these older cases, but what I'm not hearing is how you might apply them to whether you agree with them, whether you stand by them, whether you think that any kind of non-delegation principles have any effect whatsoever on Heinrich's ability to issue a local health order under the reasonable and necessary provisions of 252.03. I'd like you to tell me what limitations you see, if any, that might apply.
Well, first of all, I mean, even if we were to use this court's current doctrines to look for an ascertainable purpose and safeguards, I think those are met here. There's an ascertainable purpose to do what is reasonable and necessary to suppress the pandemic. That's very different than when you look at 252.0.
Well, I just want to take a step back for a minute. I'm sorry to interrupt, but obviously we're not challenging any specific orders in this case. So I want you to take a step back for me, if you would, and talk to me about what limits, if any, you think the Constitution might provide under any sort of non-delegation theory that could be applicable to local government, looking at these prior cases. What limitations do you see about any ability to issue orders under the reasonable and necessary clause provision of 252.03?
Well, if we're talking in terms of doctrine, I think the ascertainable purpose and the safeguards methodology that this court has utilized in many cases can be applied, and I think it's satisfied here. And in terms of what in this particular case, there are these limitations. I mean, she has to report to the governing bodies. That's clear in 252.03. She has to inform them of the measures being taken, what's going on with the communicable disease. There's also further statutory limitations that she can only take these actions during the course of the pandemic. She's only acting locally, not statewide.
She's got no kind of veto or other say. She has no say over the finances or the public purse. And as this court noted in Palm, even if all those front-end procedures are inadequate for some other reason, there's still judicial review. So at any point in time, for instance, these petitioners could have brought an action simply challenging that this particular order as applied to a particular business is not reasonable or necessary. But here we don't have that record whatsoever because they've skipped that analysis altogether.
You think the average person in Dane County can afford to bring a court action because they wanted to have their family over for Thanksgiving?
Right.
They may not. That's true. But judicial review is nonetheless available.
That can't be the only limitation on the exercise of extraordinary power.
They also have the ability to go to their county board member, to go to the county board. This is how decisions are made at the local level. All the time.
So the county board doesn't have any limitations on the restrictions it can impose on people in the name of a pandemic.
The restrictions have to be reasonable and necessary based on what's going on at the time. Right now we have vaccines. The numbers are down. She couldn't issue those kinds of directives to stay at home now. That would not be reasonable and necessary. At the time that she issued that, we were in an upswing at that time. I think we may recall that the summer of 2020, the numbers seemed to go down, and then they went back up, and that's
Counselor,
what prompted her order.
If it was reasonable and necessary, how come Dane County was the only county doing it? It was a pandemic that was statewide.
It's a good question, and it reflects the policy choices that are being made. I live in Waukesha County. Their policy choices are totally different. This
but
county,
reasonable and necessary should be an objective standard that we can all look at it and not worried about whether we live in Dane County or Waukesha County.
Because it's how it works at the local level. At the local level, the governing bodies, they're...
Reasonable and necessary is an objective standard, correct? It's not a subjective standard.
Sure. If we're talking about whether the particular order to the particular condition at the time is
right.
reasonable or necessary, yes. That would be an objective standard.
Right.
But if we're talking about why does one county, such as Dane County, set it up this way and another county or another city set it up differently, those are policy choices that can be different in different counties.
I just don't see how they fit within reasonable and necessary. I mean, I as you know from, because I wrote Palm, I think what you're talking about is way more than the statute authorizes. But as I try to put myself in your position, I have a big problem with reasonable and necessary in Dane County, which is an objective standard, and we say that in a million cases. Putting something else different in Waukesha County, I get it's a policy choice. Everything that's done in government at the bottom line is a policy choice, but the objective test to exercise that policy is what's troubling me, and I don't see how Dane County can objectively say what they did was reasonable and necessary, and Waukesha County and every other county, I think, in the state concluded differently.
Do you have an answer to that?
If I may,
you may
very
briefly
quickly.
Yes,
thank you.
That's because I think we're entangling the concepts of delegation with the statutory interpretation. And if this court looks and tries to avoid bringing doubt into the constitutionality of the statute, you can look solely at the issue of whether a particular health order telling people to wear a mask at a particular time is reasonable and necessary, and that would be objective.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. That's a fair answer. Doesn't make me happy, but it's a fair answer.
That might not have been his goal.
Counsel, I want to preempt you because I have a question I just want you to answer. I have a question on just the original understanding of some of these constitutional provisions. And I have to be honest, the briefing was heavy to me on theory and low on original understanding research. We have some statutes. Traditionally, you know, you're going to look at statutes at the time or debates around the founding to try to get a good sense for what the language means, right? If you go back to 1849, there's a law, Chapter 26, first laws ever enacted. The Board of Health may examine into all nuisances, sources of filth, causes of sickness, and make such regulations respecting the same as they may judge necessary. or the public health, safety, and safety of the inhabitants, every person who shall violate any order or regulation made by any Board of Health and duly published agreeably to the provisions of this chapter shall be deemed guilty of a misdemeanor. I'm trying to figure out what to do with language like that. I'm trying to do with, you look at some of this time at the founding, you see some of this cited in some of the briefing, there's pretty broad authority granted. The second piece is non-delegation theory is everywhere I've seen it, really premised and grounded in the vesting clauses of the Constitution. Can you give me your best original meaning argument under Article 4, Section 22, which says the legislature may confer upon the boards of supervisors of the several counties of the state such powers of a local legislative and administrative character they shall from time to time prescribe? Because I don't want to just decide this case on the theory of not vesting too much power in one person. We've got to pay attention to what the constitutional text says and what it meant. So help me out with that.
So the theory, I have to start with the theory and then I'll get to the text. So the theory is legislative power via Article 1, Section 1 is vested in the legislature at the state level. Now, initially in this state's history, the court thought that meant that the legislature couldn't even vest local legislative power on county boards. And the legislature was deciding localized questions like, can we have a phone booth down the street? And what's the grade of the sidewalk? Because the belief was legislative power is vested exclusively in the legislature, even at the local level. And that's what the Home Rule Amendment was meant to resolve, was for municipalities, we can delegate some of that legislative power from the state level to the local level, but it's got to be applied by the city council, the legislative body at the local level. So I think Article 4, Section 22, embodied that principle with respect to counties at the time of the Constitution, that the state's legislative power could be delegated in part over local issues to counties, but it could only be delegated to the boards of supervisors because those are the local legislative bodies. And I heard some discussion about whether there's, you know, similar separation of powers at the local level. There is, and you can see it in the statutes. In Chapter 59, it vests, uses the same word, vests, legislative power in county boards. Executive power is in the county executive. And so I think the same separation of power structure applies at the local level as it does at the state level. And that's why the non-delegation doctrine should apply in similar ways.
Counsel, is that enough of an answer?
Go ahead.
Do you want more?
Go ahead.
Okay. 1928, something marvelous happened here in this very room, and that was the Whitman decision. And when I look at the Whitman decision, authored by then Chief Justice Rosenberry, which was a sea change in delegation, right? And so I've only looked at a couple of pre-1928 delegation cases because it was such a sea change. On our website, the court's website, we refer to Chief Justice Rosenberry as the apostle of administrative law. That's what our website has his moniker to be, the apostle of administrative law, because he took what was all of these anti-delegation cases and administrative agency cases, and he was the first in the nation. I mean, this was big stuff. It came, of course, as a result of 1911, first constitutional workers' comp policy and all of that sort of stuff. And so I often discard the pre-1928 delegation cases. Tell me why I'm wrong in that, or tell me why I'm placing too much weight on this dear apostle who hailed from Wausau, Wisconsin, and that decision.
I mean, I think there's a lot to like in the Whitman opinion. I think even Whitman seemed to acknowledge that there are a lot of things that can't be delegated. It had some limits. But I think where Whitman went wrong is it relied primarily on necessity and efficiency. And I think that's not consistent with our constitutional design. And that's why we've asked this court to revisit the doctrine, to reinvigorate it, and to better align it with our constitutional principles.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you for interesting briefing and oral arguments. Many participants who weren't here physically in court today, but they nonetheless participated in writing. And we will break now and allow our second here for oral argument, then back out here.